It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.
Hello and welcome to this episode of Chronicles, where this time we're going to be talking all about A Tale of Two Cities by Charles Dickens. I figured it would be good to get in early with some Dickens appreciation. So Charles Dickens was born on February 7th, 1812, in Portsmouth. And from the low fortune of his early life, with his father being sent to a debtor's prison when Dickens was only a small child, to the renown and wealth that he received in his own time, Dickens experienced both the impoverished lows and the celebrity status high society of the Victorian era. And in experiencing both the best and worst of life's offerings, he became a man who just understood people from all walks of life. He understood their hopes, their dreams, and their plights. And his characters were so well realised, from the most misfortunate paupers, such as Oliver Twist, to the aristocratic exiles like Charles Darnay, who we'll be talking about more from this current novel. And, of course, his descriptions of London are so vivid, you can almost feel yourself walking the streets through his pages. And in doing this, his works came to define the Victorian era itself with the adjective of Dickensian. I had a quote that I just wanted to start off with about Dickens himself, and it's from G.K. Chesterton, very, very famous writer, philosopher and critic. And he said, "Whatever the word great means, Dickens was what it means. Even the fastidious and unhappy who cannot read his books without a continuous critical exasperation would use the word of him without stopping to think. They feel that Dickens is a great writer, even if he is not a good writer. He is treated as a classic, that is, as a king who may now be deserted, but who cannot now be dethroned." Amongst his many famous works, such as Great Expectations and, of course, A Christmas Carol, it is A Tale of Two Cities, which was published back in 1859, that went on to become one of his best-selling works, and it's sold at present over 200 million copies. And what's interesting is that of Dickens' 15 novels, only two of them are historical fiction, and this happens to be one of them. And so, in A Tale of Two Cities, Charles Dickens weaves these threads of fate and love and redemption through the intertwined lives of these private citizens of London and Paris, but always with this foreboding terror of the French Revolution, ever closer on the horizon as the years count down to the event that the readers know is coming. And to study one of the most important events, probably in all of human history, Dickens armed himself with one source above all others, which was The French Revolution, A History by Thomas Carlyle. And Dickens walked London until he knew it as well as it knew him. But his view of Paris at that moment of that disastrous epoch was very much informed by Thomas Carlyle's authority on the subject. So, without further ado, let's go through A Tale of Two Cities. It begins with one of the most famous openings in all of fiction. It was the best of times, it was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom, it was the age of foolishness. It was the epoch of belief, it was the epoch of incredulity. It was a season of light, it was a season of darkness. It was the spring of hope, it was a winter of despair. We had everything before us, we had nothing before us. We were all going direct to heaven, we were all going direct the other way. In short, the period was so far like the present period that some of its noisiest authorities insisted on its being received, for good or for evil, in a superlative degree of comparison only. With that famous opening, all told in a single, continuous sentence, the narrative begins in 1775. A man journeys to the port of Dover, pondering the news he needs to impart. Recalled to life. He is the ever-proper Mr. Jarvis Lorry, a man of business from Tellson's Bank. Inside a tavern, he meets with a young woman of surpassing elegance and beauty, Miss Lucy Manette, who is accompanied by her dependable governess, Miss Pross, who had raised Lucy ever since her mother's passing sometime during her childhood. It is revealed to Lucy that her father, whom she has never met, has for the past 18 years been jailed inside the Bastille prison in Paris. This comes as a startling shock to the poor girl, as her mother had told her that he was dead. This revelation sends Lucy into a swoon, but upon recovery, the three characters depart from England and go to bring Lucy's father to safety. The story then takes us to its second city, Paris, and we are introduced to Mr. and Mrs. Defarge, the owners of a rustic wine shop in the impoverished working-class neighbourhood of Faubourg-Saint-Antoine. When Lucy and her companions come to collect her father, they are taken to a locked room above the wine cellar, where Mr. Defarge has been keeping him since he was released from the Bastille. Upon the opening of the door, a grave sight greets them, a once-respected physician reduced to a hobbled cobbler, with overgrown hair and every hallmark of deep trauma. Slowly and with tender delicacy, Lucy is able to recall her father to life, and the repressed memories of happiness begin to bring him to his senses. They return to England with Lucy's father, but he is insistent that he takes his workbench with him so that he continue to make his shoes. We then catch up with our cast 5 years on, at the Old Bailey in London, where Mr. Charles Darnay stands accused of being a French spy. The American Revolution rises across the ocean, and Britain can ill afford the French to undermine her efforts to maintain her colonies. But this is a stitch-up, by the machinations of Darnay's uncle, the Marquis de Evermond, and his turncoat lapdog, John Bassard. In the viewing gallery sits Lucy, accompanied by her now fully restored father, Dr. Manette. Despite the doctor's testimony and the bombastic defence of the lawyer, Mr. Stryver, aptly named, it seems like the verdict will be guilty. That is until Stryver's assistant, Mr. Sidney Carlton, intercedes, remarking on the peculiar resemblance between himself and the accused. Despite the dishevelled, drunken display from Sidney Carlton, his case casts enough doubt on the jury as to whether or not they have the right man that Charles Darnay is acquitted and allowed to go free. Lucy is delighted, having met Darnay on the passage back across the Channel, where he was every bit the gentleman, his manners impeccable, his countenance noble, and his virtues self-evident. You see, Darnay was born into the French aristocracy, but he decides to become a private citizen and forego his privileges to work an honest job in England. His uncle is a distant, cold and tyrannical figure, embodying everything that will light the powder keg of the French Revolution. And after a last frosty farewell between Darnay and his uncle, the Marquis is murdered in his sleep as a foreshadowing of the upheaval to come. Another year passes, and Darnay approaches Dr. Manette about the prospects of marriage to his beloved daughter Lucy. She is the most precious thing in both men's lives. Dr. Manette gives his blessing, but tells Darnay that whatever the secrets of his past may be, they can wait until after the wedding. By this time, Lucy has become one of the most desirable women in London, with Mr. Stryver intending to propose, and even the drunken wastrel Sidney Carton privately falling in love with her. Carton is a man whose life has always been full of potential in law and in love, a man that could be Darnay if he only put down the bottle and tried. But he is who he is, and his love for Lucy is unrequited. But in revealing his feelings to her, he makes a solemn promise. For you, and for any dear to you, I would do anything. If my career were of the better kind, that there was an opportunity or capacity of sacrifice in it, I would embrace any sacrifice for you and for those dear to you. Soon, the time comes for the wedding of Lucy and Charles. For the wedded couple, it is a perfect day. But for Dr. Manette, who had finally heard from Charles the truth of his Evermond heritage, it brings back the trauma of the Bastille. And while the newlyweds are on their honeymoon, the doctor devolves into his broken, shoemaking submissiveness. After a nerve-wracking week for Mr. Lorry and Miss Pross, not knowing how or when Lucy's father will recover his senses, he appears the next morning with no recollection of his strangeness. But it is agreed that at a moment when he cannot notice, his workbench and shoemaking tools will be taken away from him and discarded. Mr. Lorry handles all of this with such delicacy that Lucy, the daughter, is unaware of her father's relapse. Years pass. Lucy and Charles have a daughter, little Lucy, who grows up surrounded by the happiness and health of her family and friends in the safety and peace of London. But in Paris, seismic events are taking place. The Defarges and other Parisians revolt against the Ancien Régime and storm the Bastille. Society is quickly breaking down. The revolution continues to ferment over the passing few years, and a former servant of Charles Darnay's is put in jeopardy. Knowing the danger and the risk of losing all that life has given him, Darnay, out of this sense of noblesse oblige, returns to revolutionary Paris to save his former servant. But as a former aristocrat, the law forbids his return, though this law did not exist when he set forth. And so now, in order to save Darnay's life, the vortex of anarchy at the heart of the revolution pulls Lucy, her father, and their friends towards Paris to save Charles's life. The streets of Paris are thronged with mobs, and Madame Guillotine's razor of justice is measured by bystanders to the number of pipe barrels it can smoke as she fells through the queue of accused. All attend the trial of Charles Darnay. And this is a test of strength for Dr. Manette as he stands before the mob and attempts to save the life of his son-in-law. Remarkably, against all odds, Darnay is declared innocent, and all seems to have gone seamlessly well. But that same day, Darnay is rearrested, and another trial takes place. The architect of the sinister plot to kill Charles is none other than Madame Defarge, the ever-knitting, ever-vengeful, ever-merciless woman whose life was irrevocably ruined by the Evermond family. And Charles, blameless though he is, will be persecuted for as long as it takes for Madame Defarge to see his head removed and all the joys of his life eradicated. When the Bastille was stormed back in 1789, a letter was found hidden in Dr. Manette's cell. It is then read aloud for the tribunal and all the spectators to hear. In decades past, Dr. Manette had been brought urgently in the night to save a young woman's life. Her wounds are grave, and she is clinging to life after suffering a vile rape at the hands of one of the Evermonds. Her brother lays in the next room, having tried to rescue her, only to be mortally wounded. He beseeches the doctor to hear of the peasantry's plight. "We were so robbed by that man who stands there, as all we common dogs are by those superior beings. Taxed by him without mercy, obliged to work for him without pay, obliged to grind our corn at the mill, obliged to feed scores of his tame birds on our own wretched crops, and forbidden for our lives to keep a single tame bird of our own. Pillaged and plundered to that degree that when we chanced to have a bit of meat, we ate it in fear, with the door barred and the shutters closed, that his people should not see it and take it from us. I say we were so robbed and hunted, and were made so poor, that our father told us it was a dreadful thing to bring a child into the world, and what we should most pray for, that our women might be barren, and our miserable race die out. After such suffering, both the brother and sister die, and Dr. Manette is threatened not to tell of what happened by the Marquis. But the doctor's conscience will not allow it, and in his attempt to report the Evremonts' crimes to the authorities, they have Dr. Manette imprisoned in the Bastille. Hearing this letter read aloud before the tribunal, the trauma of the past once more breaks Dr. Manette's psyche, and it seems that for Lucy and her loved ones, she has run out of saviours. The tour de force of vengeance that the revolution has unleashed cannot be reasoned with. But then, with Lucy's life threatened, her saviour arrives. It is Sidney Carton. With the clarity and call to action that has eluded him all his life, he masterminds a plan to help Darnay escape and see him and his family safely back to England, gaining entry to the prison cell of the man whose life he has always envied. After exchanging clothes, he drugs Darnay and has him taken away to safety, and the resemblance of the two leaves the revolutionaries none the wiser regarding the switch. Across the city, Madame Defarge moves like a wraith, determined to have Lucy and her daughter killed. But Miss Pross, the aging, forever loyal governess, faces her down in an altercation that ends with Defarge accidentally killing herself with her own revolver. All of the characters that we've come to care for manage to escape back to the sanctuary of England, all except the story's true hero, as Sidney Carton, in complete peace of mind, steps towards the guillotine and meditates upon his life. "I am the resurrection and the life, saith the Lord. He that believeth in me, though he were dead, yet shall he live. And whosoever liveth and believeth in me shall never die." As his doom approaches, he peacefully reflects on the future, the healing of Paris, and the happiness and gratitude that his sacrifice will bring. In one of the most powerful passages that, frankly, I've ever read, "I see a beautiful city and a brilliant people rising from this abyss, and in their struggles to be truly free, in their triumphs and defeats, through long years to come, I see the evil of this time and of the previous time of which this is a natural birth, gradually making expiation for itself and wearing out. I see the lives for which I lay down my life, peaceful, useful, prosperous and happy, in that England which I shall see no more. I see that I hold a sanctuary in their hearts and in the hearts of their descendants generations hence. I see her, an old woman, weeping for me on the anniversary of this day. I see her and her husband, their course done, lying side by side in their last earthly bed. And I know that each was not more honoured and held sacred in the other's soul than I was in the souls of both. I see that child who lay upon her bosom and who bore my name, a man winning his way up in that path of life which once was mine. I see him winning it so well that my name is made illustrious there by the light of his. I see the blots I threw upon it faded away. I see him, foremost of just judges and honoured men, bringing a boy of my name, with a forehead that I know and golden hair, to this place, then fair to look upon, with not a trace of this day's disfigurement. And I hear him tell the child my story, with a tender and a faltering voice. It is a far, far better thing that I do than I have ever done. It is a far, far better rest that I go to than I have ever known. Of course, the most central themes of A Tale of Two Cities are both revolution and duality. The two cities of the tale, London and Paris, in many ways contrasting examples of civilization. And Charles Dickens, being a man of the city who loved London with all of his heart, was very much warning against what might befall the city that he loves if the society, Victorian rigid society, was unwilling to bend and move with the times, as is what happened with the downfall of the Ancien Régime. In the story, London represents a sanctuary, a place of law, society and manners, and Paris, by example, becomes a place of blood and anarchy and mobs and untrammeled persecution. As Dickens lays out in that very famous opening about it being the best of times and the worst of times, what he's really saying is that it's an age of contradictions, it's an age of opposites, and it's an age of remarkable instability. And so he goes on later on in that same introductory chapter to talk about the fact that, well, there was a king in England with a square jaw, and there was a king in France with a square jaw. There was a queen with a plain face, and there was a queen with a pretty face. And what he's really saying with this is that don't think that England and France are so unlike that the fate of France may not also befall England. But it's very interesting to note as well that it is England throughout the entire story. So you have the character of Charles Darnay, who basically renounces his Frenchness. He basically says, yes, I'm leaving all of that behind and I'm going to go to England, which is really the only sensible place for any man to live. And it's very interesting to see that Dickens is both sensitive to the reasons for why the French Revolution happened in the first place, whilst also essentially disavowing everything that took place in the actual revolution itself.
If you enjoyed this piece of premium content from the Lotus Eaters, head to our website where you can find more.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com, and live the Chumba life.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.